Well, there is new evidence that Houston, we have a problem with natural extraterrestrial threats, natural now to survival of life on Earth. And the question is, with some of the greatest minds in astrobiology just screaming up and down, wake up and smell the risk, why are we having so much trouble getting the attention of leaders, politicians, and getting the research done? In a moment, as we talk about nanotechnology with our special guest tonight, Douglas Mulhall, on Coast to Coast AM. Douglas Mulhall is a leading nanotechnology journalist and award-winning documentary filmmaker, broadcast executive. Douglas has led at least one other life as a pioneer in scientific research that has helped him in his books and his work. His landmark book is called Our Molecular Future, describing very powerful new tools to save the globalized economy from nature's time bombs. He's also written the book called The Calcium Bomb to help people who have the potential of heart disease and cancer. He's our guest this hour on Coast to Coast. Douglas, how are you?
I'm fine, George. Thanks for having me.
Oh, likewise. Thanks for coming on at this short notice as well.
Well, nice to be back.
Well, so what's going on this planet, Douglas, where, you know, our leaders simply aren't listening to our scientists who are desperately trying to tell them that there's a threat out there?
Well, George, there's big threats and little threats, but what we're going to be talking about tonight is these really nasty surprises that come along. And on the relatively small scale, you know, where you're broadcasting from tonight, just less than 100 years ago, most people are unaware that one of the biggest earthquakes in the history of the United States actually occurred not far from St. Louis.
New Madrid Fault, right?
That's right, the New Madrid Fault. And we've talked about this before, but for those of your listeners who haven't heard it, basically between 1811 and 1812, there was a series of enormous earthquakes that occurred around St. Louis, and they were at least 8.0 or higher on the Richter scale compared to, for example, 6.5, which was the last San Francisco earthquake. So you can just imagine that this was at least 100 times more powerful than what occurred in San Francisco. And this quake was felt across almost the entire continental United States. It changed the course of the Mississippi River. Had it flowing one direction, and after the earthquake, it was flowing in another.
It went back up north, didn't it?
That's correct. And yet, it is relatively unknown because the area was quite sparsely populated at that time, and so really no one paid that much attention to it despite its enormous magnitude. Now, if that same event were to occur today in the same location, you can just imagine the type of damage and loss of life that would occur. And yet, most people who live in that area of the world are blissfully unaware of the risk that this poses, and that is witnessed by the fact that, for example, most buildings are not built to any type of specification in the area that would stand that type of shock. So that is your kind of classic example that we have in the United States, where people are really not aware that the biggest earthquake risk in terms of potential damage is not along the west coast of the United States, but in fact almost in the middle of the country. Now,
You know, Douglas, most people, I've got to tell you this story, most people have seen the St. Louis Arch either whenever they're taking pictures of St. Louis Cardinal baseball or football games. You know, the networks always show the arch. So if people haven't been to St. Louis, they probably have seen it on television. Well, a lot of people might not know it, but the arch, of course, is very close to the banks of the Mississippi, and you can go up it. They have like a little conveyor elevator that kind of goes up the arm of the arch, and it curves, so it kind of clicks, and you're always feeling as if you're going straight, but the thing curves. Anyway, you get on the top of this thing, Douglas. You can go inside the arch. You get out of this little elevator, and I'm telling you, when you're up there, it sways. You can feel the motion, and I've always wondered if a major earthquake hit like the one you just said, Would that knock the arch down? What do you think?
Well, you know, oddly enough, those types of structures are probably better attuned because of their height to deal with the frequency of waves than a lot of the lower structures. It's actually the lower structures that most of us live in. You know what they say? They say earthquakes don't kill people, buildings do.
Yeah.
And that is extremely true in that area because the lower buildings are just not constructed to withstand that kind of shock. So ironically, a lot of these higher structures actually are built at a so-called period of wave that can withstand these types of shocks. Of course, at 8.0 on the Richter scale, one only can imagine whether or not the thing would still stand up, but that would be the least of people's problems at that point. And I think that it's such a good example because it really shows that here we have something that's staring us in the face that we know happens regularly once every century or so. And yet, looking at situations like we just saw, for example, with Hurricane Katrina, we know that these things occur, and yet our leaders repeatedly seem unable to fathom this risk that is staring them in the face. And so what do? They wait until it comes along, and even after it comes along, and even after all of this has happened, they still seem incapable of fixing the problem or dealing with what might come along the next time.
Well, and they can't fix the problem, as demonstrated with Katrina.
No, and the point is that this book that I wrote several years ago now, Our Molecular Future, was directed at two things. The first thing was to inform people, and your program has been very good at this, and we're now seeing that this is becoming mainstream, that the convergence of nanotechnology and robotics and genetics and artificial intelligence is resulting in this dramatic acceleration of technology. So that's the first thing. But the next thing is that because of this, for the first time, we may actually be able to develop technologies that help us to withstand and recover from these disasters very quickly. And for example, in the case of earthquakes, all you need to do is look at these new materials that are being developed. And one example that I always use is something called aerogels. Now, aerogels were those little things that were actually in the Stardust aircraft, spacecraft that just came back from space gathering these particles from comets.
That's what captured the Stardust, right?
Yeah, now aerogels are 99% air, but the nice thing about them is that they are super strong and super flexible. And recently, aerogels have been reinvented with nanotechnology, making them 100 times more strong and flexible than conventional aerogels, which used to suffer from brittleness. Now, the genius about these new materials is that you can use them for wall coverings, but they become structural materials. You can use them for window coverings because they're transparent. And guess what? All of a sudden, you have an affordable material that can be used in construction that can withstand a lot of these pressures from hurricanes and tornadoes and earthquakes that before we could never ramp up on a massive scale and make affordable for the whole population, you know, to put in your own home. So those are the kinds of developments that are occurring right now before our eyes that are coming into the marketplace. Do you hear any of our politicians talking about a program where FEMA, for example, would roll something like this out, or that perhaps subsidies would be given to the construction industry to increase the adoption level for these types of new technologies?
Nope.
No. There is a giant disconnect between our leadership, our emergency response agencies, and the new technologies that are coming online. And that is the message that I brought out in Our Molecular Future several years ago now. And even now, I have to say, you know, after I've written another book after that, that book is actually more current when we see what's happened with Katrina. We see the risk of what could happen with the New Madrid Fault. And what we can talk about in a little bit is that our science is now discovering a bunch of new risks that we have always known about, but that we now are learning are much more frequent in our solar system and in our galaxy and in our universe, that pose much more grave threats to our survival. And one example of that that actually just occurred a few days ago, it was detected, it was on the front page of USA Today, was a one of the closest supernova explosions.
Oh, that one was huge, wasn't it?
It was an enormous explosion, and it was one of the closest supernova explosions to occur to Earth. Fortunately, it was 440 million light years away, so basically we are safe from that one. However, there is a series of larger explosions, and when I say larger, I mean far larger explosions. They are mega supernovas, and actually our scientists have just started being able to accurately detect them in the last 5 or 7 years, and they generate something known as a gamma ray burst. Now, gamma ray bursts are capable at relatively close range of basically wiping out everything that is alive on Earth, including to the bottom of the ocean. That's the bad news. The good news is that although they occur more than once every day within telescope shot of our galaxy, they have never been known to occur close enough to us to do any damage.
So even let's say millions of years ago, do we have any data at all, Douglas?
Well, there is most of the data at this point is based on calculations rather than hard evidence, George. The calculations are that one occurs every 100 million years ago or so, that regularly every 100 million years or so, that is that has been close enough to Earth to cause mass extinctions. And there is a hot and heavy argument right now in the scientific community as to whether this, in fact, has been the cause of these mass extinctions, not just gigantic asteroids hitting the Earth, as, you know, a lot of people have heard about these asteroids hitting the Earth and destroying the dinosaurs and all of that, but that has not explained a lot of these other mass extinctions that have occurred with no evidence of comet or asteroid impacts, and it's theorized that these gamma ray bursts have been the problem.
Well, give me an example, though. If a gamma ray burst hit us now, how would it happen? And then what basically would happen to us? I mean, would we be fried instantly? Well, how would affect us?
There have been actually a couple of academic papers written on this, and one was done by an Israeli in 2002. And he was examining one of two or three giant superstars that are in our own galaxy that are currently unstable and are capable of collapsing into black holes. And these superstars, for example, are millions of times more luminous than our sun and great deal larger. What they have calculated is, and there's one thing that's important to understand, gamma ray bursts don't simply go out equally in all directions. They are focused, and this is the risk. They focus along a certain plane, and so if Earth happened to be on that plane, we would have big problems. And so there are these two or three superstars that are unstable, that are in our galaxy, that have a potential of creating these enormous gamma ray bursts. Now, to answer your question, if one of those gamma ray bursts of that magnitude was to hit Earth, it would be the equivalent of a kiloton of explosives going off in the atmosphere for every square kilometer of atmosphere.
Oh, my gosh.
And that would effectively destroy the ozone layer and immediately irradiate everything down to the bottom of the ocean. Now, here's the thing. There are two things at work here. One is gigantic denial that, well, actually, there's nothing that we can do about this, and so we might as well not think about it. So that's number one. But in the face of that is science. And what is happening with the development of our science over the last 10 years is that we are beginning to understand the true nature of these kinds of threats. And when you put those things together with, for example, the case in 1996 where Comet Shoemaker-Levy 9 ran into Jupiter and hit and made Earth-sized holes, 9 of them, in Jupiter's atmosphere, with the possibility that we could have, as another example, gigantic supervolcanoes, which we now know have occurred in the history of the Earth and have blackened the atmosphere for years at a time, wiping out most life forms. When you look at these types of gigantic, infrequent but gigantic occurrences, you realize one thing. We're living in a hostile universe. This place is not usually friendly to life. And as a result of that, there are a number of very smart people who have been doing this research in the astrobiology area, for example, at NASA, but also in a number of other areas of science. And they have basically started saying to our leaders, wake up and smell the risk, guys.
Now, but what can you do, Douglas, if, I mean, as a society, what can we do to fight a gamma burst?
Well, I think that, first of all, most importantly, we have to recognize that these risks exist and get our leaders to start paying attention to funding the research required to answer the question that you have just asked. So that's number one, is recognize that we have a problem here. Number two, there is a reason why we have a space program, and it's not just to beat the Russians to the moon. The other reason is that ultimately, the only way, George, to effectively guarantee the survival of the human species is to make it first to another planet and then make it to another solar system and populate the human species throughout the galaxy. Now, you know that even 10 or 15 years ago, to say something like that would have sounded like lunacy because, oh, we don't have the resources and we don't have the technology. But as we see these nanotechnologies coming forward and we see now that, you know, countries like China are putting their own astronauts in orbit and have announced that they're going to the moon, you see in the U.S. that George Bush saying we're going back to the moon is actually almost a non-event because it's such a limp program that they put in place compared to what our technological capabilities are now, that we can actually really do something if we put our minds to it. We could now go to the moon and establish bases there. We could go to Mars without bankrupting the whole economy of the United States. If we took the same amount of money that we dropped on Iraq and put it into a Mars project, we would have been there by now. And moreover, we're developing the propulsion capabilities that could take us to a place like Mars in a matter of a month or two instead of the 6 or 7 or 8 months that it takes now. And one of the biggest challenges that we have been facing in space and in going to Mars over the last 15 or 20 years has been the time it takes to get there because your astronauts are exposed to some extremely serious radiation risks
plus,
on the way there.
Douglas, they'd go out of their mind. They'd get so, you know what, the human mind, I don't think, can stand 9 months or a year one way of just sitting in a capsule.
Yeah.
I just don't think they could handle it.
Exactly. And yet, when you look at the possibilities of nuclear propulsion, for example, and also solar sails and a whole bunch of other technologies that are not just on the drawing boards but are in the developmental phase, I think we can understand fairly quickly that if we put our minds to it, we could solve this problem and we could start getting to places like Mars in a matter of weeks or a couple of months, which is entirely tolerable because people used to do it when they got on ships to go across the Atlantic to the New World. So we know that at that level, we can certainly put up with that period of time. But we need different propulsion. And I think it's actually a relatively good sign that recently, for example, the National Aeronautics and Space Administration has decided to focus more on things like rocketry, because I think that is really a key to achieving this type of capability.
Hey, Douglas, when we come back, let's talk about how we can really leave this planet and how many people should go. Much more to talk about with our guest, Douglas Mulhall. His website's linked up at coasttocoastam.com. We'll be right back. Well, we're back to the old promotion for the After Dark newsletter where you get 14 issues for the price of 12. Well worth it. Call 1-888-727-5505. Their operators are 24 hours a day. 1-888-727-5505. Or to take advantage again, 14 issues for the price of 12. You go to the coasttocoastam.com website. There is a secure server. And just click right there where it says After Dark. So do you believe that we should at least start venturing soon to these other regions of the solar system, Douglas?
Not only do I believe we should, and I'm not the only one who's saying this, but we can. And I think that's the most important thing. And, George, I have to say that, you know, your show is one of the few shows that is really dedicated to telling people the truth about stuff like this, because the truth is becoming more and more apparent about the risks that we face and the capabilities that we have. And I just want to give you one example, and
okay.
Actually this is some news that just broke last week. You and I have talked on earlier shows about this concept of the space elevator.
Yep.
Now, the space elevator is basically a thin ribbon stretching from the equator up about 62,000 miles into geosynchronous orbit with a tether at the other end that allows us to get away from all of this nonsense of having to have rockets running into space all the time. And instead, you can just take a robot and move up this cable into geosynchronous orbit and launch things into orbit and construct very large structures at an economically reasonable rate. Now, the space elevator idea has been around for years, but has always been thought to be impractical for one very simple reason. If you're going to have a 60,000-mile cable running out into space, with conventional materials, the base would have to be at about 100 miles thick, and like the Tower of Babel, it would collapse upon itself very quickly.
Exactly.
So it's been completely unreasonable to think about it until about 4 years ago, when nanostructured materials were invented, such as the aerogels that I spoke about earlier, but other types of materials as well, that are about 30 times stronger and with greater tensile strength than carbon steel.
How thick would it be, that elevator in the shaft?
Well, it's interesting you should ask that, because last week, a company by the name of Liftport Group, which is a private U.S. company, did a proof of concept of a space elevator by taking a carbon ribbon and stretching it up with a balloon a mile straight up and running a robot up that. Now, this particular ribbon was about the thickness of 6 sheets of paper, and it goes up a mile. So that is the type of strength that we are now talking about with very, very thin materials.
Douglas, I would hate to be in the plane that accidentally got tangled up in this thing as it was flying. I mean, what are the dangers of something like that happening, of somebody in a plane, some object, just getting caught in this thing, though it's hanging straight down, right?
Yeah, relatively little compared to all of the other towers that we have. I mean, if you look at the CN Tower in Toronto that is right in the flight path of the international airport there, no one has run into that yet. So I think that would actually be a relatively small risk, especially, of course, compared to the benefits, because you'd be able to move thousands of tons of material into geosynchronous orbit. And at that point, George, once we can do that, then we can build very advanced propulsion systems in space that can take us to places like Mars in a very short period of time. So the space elevator, I think, is a critical link. And this company claims that they plan to build a commercial space elevator by the year 2018, which is like 12 years from now. And so when you're getting private U.S. companies throwing out those kinds of numbers, regardless of how optimistic they might seem, you're starting to see some realism here. And the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, despite their inability to keep space shuttles flying, actually does have some occasional good ideas. And one of them is something that is known as the Centennial Challenges Program. And that has been a type of XPRIZE award for companies to show proof of concept for two things. The first thing is to to get these space cables up there and to show that they can go great distances vertically and be held taut enough for the second thing to happen, and that is a robot to move vertically up them to the top carrying a payload. So those are the two components of this Centennial Challenge program, and this company, Liftport, that I'm just talking about, is actually responding to that challenge that was put out there by NASA, and that's the reason we've finally seen this first proof of concept on the space elevator. So it's actually quite exciting because none of this stuff was feasible even 4 years ago, and that's how fast the technology is moving.
Well, in Douglas, if Robert Bigelow ever gets his plan together for a space hotel, can you imagine using a space elevator to get people up there?
That would work, wouldn't it? That's exactly the point. I mean, when you're talking about the type of XPRIZE rockets into space that we've just seen in the last year, that's nothing compared to being able to transport hundreds of thousands of people a year up to a hotel in space. And again, I have to emphasize, this stuff was science fiction until 4 or 5 years ago, and it is the nanotechnology revolution that is happening in hundreds of universities and companies around the world simultaneously that really gives us the first glimpse that this will be reality in the near future. And when I say in the near future, certainly in most of our lifetimes.
Can you imagine what the floor button would be on this elevator for this hotel? Floor number 260,000 or whatever.
Exactly. Yep, don't fall out.
No, not
at all. Well, actually, it would be okay if you fell out at the right altitude because then you'd be weightless. But so that's definitely one, I think, one of the great promises that we have for doing this. The second thing is, answering your question that you asked before the break, is the propulsion systems themselves. And here, I guess I have to say something. I've been an environmental science manager for many, many years before I started writing these books. And so I'm quite familiar with the concerns of environmentalists about nuclear energy. And in fact, I did the original documentary film showing the path of uranium from the mine to the bomb. So I'm quite familiar with the risks of nuclear energy. However, having said that, I have to take issue with my fellow environmentalists who are opposing the use of things like nuclear propulsion in space because, for example, of some of the risks of getting the stuff up there.
Mm-hmm.
I maintain, and this is one of the things that I said in my book, Our Molecular Future, I maintain that this concept that environmentalists have of Earth being a closed system is nonsense. We have to start to recognize that Earth is an open system. It is open to the universe. It receives radiation. It vents atmosphere out into space. I mean, we are a part of this solar system and this galaxy. And when you realize that, when you look at environmentalism from that point of view, you understand that we are also open to these catastrophic risks from space. And if environmentalism is all about preserving species, then we'd better start looking at the relative risks of doing things like nuclear propulsion compared to protecting the human species from being wiped out because they're only limited to one planet. So I really take issue with the current definitions of environmentalism that are limiting our visions of what we are as a species, of how this planet really operates in the galaxy. And I think it's about time that we started having a dramatically new look at environmentalism so that we got this, plug out of us that lets us think more realistically about how to protect not only the human species, but all other species of life by taking their seed to other planets so we can propagate and protect ourselves from these catastrophic risks.
Why hasn't anybody really investigated Tesla's work, for example, and try to pull out this free energy that's always in the universe and maybe use that as a propulsion system as well?
Well, here's the answer to that. Why, after 15 years of having technologies that could replace fossil fuels, are we fighting wars over this stuff in the Middle East when all we need to do, especially with the nanotechnologies that we have today, is reserve a good portion of the Nevada desert for photovoltaic cells that can now be printed on flexible backgrounds, roll the stuff out over a quarter of the state of Nevada, and kiss the Middle East goodbye and let them have their problems. It is connected to the same mentality, and it's called vested interest. And it's something that your show has been talking about time and time again. And again, I appreciate that your show has been focusing on finding out the truth about these things, because the truth is that we have the technologies. We have the technologies for the United States and for all countries to be energy self-sufficient. We have the technologies to explore now Tesla's discoveries. We have the capability to do this if we can get the truth out there so that people are not continually imprisoned by these vested interests, these tremendous economic interests that are working against the interests of the American people.
Aren't they working on nano solar panels and things like that that will give people the capability of having much better energy efficient sun solar panels?
Well, as an example, there are at least five companies in the United States and Europe that are beginning to roll out what are known as organic plastics, that are capable of acting like paint. So you can take solar paint and paint it onto a surface. And the advantage of it is it's not tremendously efficient, but it is extremely cheap and it is extremely flexible. So for the first time, we're seeing that universities are able to paint these materials on surfaces and generate a photovoltaic current at a cost that is exponentially lower. And by the way, the cost of solar energy has already dropped 99% from what it was 20 years ago. And we're rapidly reaching the point where it is competitive with, for example, coal-fired power plants, even these massively subsidized coal-fired plants. So, because of these nanostructured materials, we are seeing these photovoltaic materials that are now able to supersede oil and to supersede coal-fired electricity in order to free us from these restrictions. But lined up against this are these old-world interests that are making so much money out of having this high-priced oil being sold at, you know, these outrageous prices, when in fact we could free ourselves from it quite easily.
And you know one of the reasons why, Douglas, I'm now convinced that they don't care about changing, because they figure, you know what, they won't be alive, so they might as well enjoy the billions they're going to reap off us right now. That's got to be one of the reasons. They just don't care about the future because they're not going to be part of it.
Well, and you know, the future may have the last laugh on them because, and you've talked about this in your other shows, the whole issue of longevity is really coming to the forefront. And I believe that it will be the solution to a lot of these problems, because as soon as people start realizing that you're going to be living 200 or 250 years, which if you look at the last century progress in the rate of longevity is entirely within the realm of what has been going on already. I mean, the human lifespan has doubled in the past century and a half. And there is no reason whatsoever that it cannot double again in the next 25 to 40 years. So if these guys think that they aren't going to be around, the future is going to have the last laugh on them. And I think that that is one of the driving forces that is going to encourage us to do things like get out into space and to these other planets, because as we live longer, I think we're going to realize that you can't just simply blow your load, screw everybody, and then not be around to worry about the results, because you are going to be around to worry about the results. So I think that the whole longevity movement that is being driven by these genetic, not only genetic technologies, but also if you look at all of the organ replacement programs that are going on right now and everything that we've talked about on earlier programs, such as being able to print brain cells now. All of these converging technologies are resulting in a dramatic possibility to increase our lifespans. And as our lifespans increase, I believe that we will naturally, as a species, come to the conclusion that we have to put a whole lot more resources into getting off the planet and getting somewhere else. So I think the longevity movement is actually going to be absolutely central to overcoming these silly oil wars and these silly short-sighted corporate priorities.
I got to tell you, I am toying what I would do, because science and nanotechnology will eventually be able to make chips, I'm convinced, to download our memories. And aside from the soul, and I haven't been able to figure out yet how science is going to handle that portion of it, we really are, Douglas, just the process of bones and flesh, but it's our memory that makes us who we are. It's our personality. It's what we become. If they can take that memory, put it on a chip, download it into a brain of a new clone, a new me, a new you, you literally live forever. Now, again, I haven't gotten over the soul situation yet. I don't know what we would do about that.
Well, George, let's take a concrete example today. You know, people who have macular degeneration are starting to have retinal implants that are consisting of several thousand computer chips. And these retinal implants are implanted into the back of the eye, and they are connected directly to the optical nerve. So what's happening is you've got computers that are interpreting light, and that is connected directly to the brain. Now, concurrent with that, for the first time in the last 12 months, there was an example where a quadriplegic individual had a internet-based implant in his brain that allowed him to draw pictures on a computer by thinking. Now, all you need to do is take those two technologies and put them together, and what you have is the human brain being connected directly to the internet. Now, think about the internet for a moment. What has happened with the internet is that we have seen a massive upgrading of the entire memory capacity of humanity, because people can recall things on the internet faster than they can trying to think of them. Our memories are being enhanced by the World Wide Web. When you take that capacity and you connect it through the optical nerve or directly into the brain, you're getting exactly what you're talking about. So we're not discussing something that is going to happen 10 or 20 or 30 years into the future. We are beginning to see the massive enhancement of human capability. Now, let's do that in reverse. What happens when you connect the human brain through the internet to another human brain that has the same retinal implant through the optical nerve? What you're beginning to see is that very soon we will be able to be in multiple places
at
with
one
the
time.
Same individual.
Absolutely. And also communicate with them.
Absolutely. And so when you start to get that kind of multiplicity, then you're starting to see a massive upgrading of human intelligence. And maybe that kind of upgrading is what's going to get us out of these silly, retrograde, old world problems that are really just stopping us from doing some magnificent things.
Douglas, thanks for being on the program. We'll be talking to you soon.
Thanks very much for having me.
That's Douglas Mulhall. Now, Charles Ostman for two more hours of some incredible nanotechnology in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.